You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today, as we are here every day, Monday through Friday, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And today, being Friday, we are here today with my good friend, Mr. Deacon, not Mr., I keep forgetting, Deacon Stephen Gradonis. How you doing, Steve?
I'm good. It's Friday. And yeah. It's the end of the workday, and I'm looking forward to a weekend in which I have a lot more work to do. How about you?
In the words of REM, it's the end of the week as we know it, and I feel fine. I'm finishing up a little essay that I'm doing. The diocesan paper, magazine called Northwest Catholic out here. They asked me to do a piece on telling the great story for Easter. What is it that's at the core of our faith? Which surprisingly, a lot of Catholics find themselves kind of tongue-tied about. They can say the creed because that's memorized, telling the great story as the kerygma, as Bishop Barron has described it, the great story of who Jesus is and what he did, and using your own words to do it, is something that a lot of Catholics find extremely difficult. And one of the results of that is our church is hemorrhaging to death in the United States. For every convert that we have, there are 6 people leaving our church. And one major reason for that is they don't connect the story of Jesus with what goes on in the Mass.
Yes.
The Mass is this thing that we do because it's this thing that we do. And if you know the connection because you actually know the great story of Jesus, which is to say his passion, death, resurrection, and ascension, and what that actually has to do with what's going on in the Mass, then the Mass can be fruitful for you. But for a lot of people, that connection is never made, and consequently, the day eventually arrives when they say, I don't know why I do this thing that we do, and it doesn't mean anything to me. Bye. So anyway, I'm writing a piece basically just trying to spell out what is the great story? What's the deal with the passion, death, and resurrection of Jesus? Why does it matter? And how is it connected to what we're doing in the Mass? So that's what I'll be finishing up, getting off to our Northwest Catholic. You preached last weekend, so you're not preaching this weekend, right? Hello? We appear to have lost Steve, or did we lose me? I don't even know. Can you hear me? Danny? Trying to get Steve back in. Okay. So, yeah. Well, that's what I'm up to this weekend. And I think that it is really crucial for us as Catholics to learn how to articulate the great story. The good thing is that, and I've said this, I think, in the past, that in a lot of ways, what we call the Paschal mystery, the passion, death, and resurrection of Jesus, the nice thing is that that story is imprinted on all of reality, and it keeps turning up in all of our stories. So we see the story acted out again. We see it imprinted on reality in all kinds of different ways. You see it, for example, in the cycle of the crops. Every year, just like we have a liturgical year, we have the seasons of the year. And in those seasons, what we experience is death, and then the resurrection in the new crops coming forward, and finally this fruitfulness, this abundant fruitfulness that comes out of it. You see it out here in Washington, you see it in the life cycle of the salmon. Fish that goes and is born in our streams, swims all the way to Alaska, comes back, and as its final act, it dies and then gives new life in the same stream in which it was born. Gee whiz, I mean, its eggs even look like little rosary beads, you know. So it's something that we see printed on reality. It's the experience that we all go through, this experience of loss and death, but also new life that happens to us. And we see it above all, of course, in the life of Jesus. And the life of Jesus is itself anticipated by the experience of Israel. That's why there's an Old Testament. Augustine famously said that the New Testament is hidden in the Old, and the Old Testament is only fully revealed in the New. And so the experience of Israel itself and Israel's experience of the reception of the law, their breaking of the law, that experience of death, the judgment that came from that, and then their restoration after the Babylonian captivity is itself an experience of life, death, and resurrection. And Israel's cultic practices also anticipate the coming of Jesus. The prophets anticipate the coming of Jesus and talk about him as a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and yet at the same time, he was bruised for our transgressions and wounded for our iniquities, and by his stripes we are healed, says Isaiah. And so when Jesus appears to his disciples on the Emmaus Road, what the disciples on the Emmaus Road hear from him is everything that was written in the life and the experience of Israel, everything that's written in the Old Testament was really about me. And that is, once again, we see that anticipation going on. Oh, look, it's Steve Gradonis. He's back.
I am.
Hello there.
I am.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Our Wi-Fi just suddenly went out. It's really weird.
Okay. It's probably the Russians. I'm going to go ahead and blame the Russians. So
I've heard they're to blame for a lot of things lately.
They do everything pretty much.
It sounded like the beginning and an end of a really interesting discussion that I would have liked to take part.
It was super duper interesting, but now I'm going to go ahead and be boring and just kind of concede everything to you until your Wi-Fi goes out again, and then I'm going to be just a scintillating synthesis of brilliance again while you're off the air. But,
well, you know, the thing that you were saying about the Mass and the story of Jesus, that is, you know, and the fact that you seemed to be, from what little I heard at the beginning of the conversation, connecting to Easter, I think is really, really important to understand that the Easter Triduum, from the evening on Holy Thursday through the evening on Easter Sunday, this is really kind of the nexus or the pinnacle from which the whole of Catholic worship and the liturgical year and the Mass and the work week and everything flows from that.
Right.
And it just we have Christmas and the fact that we have Advent and Lent and ordinary time and it all comes from Easter,
right?
It all comes from the Passion and the crucifixion and the resurrection of Jesus and all of that, all of those three things are inseparably what we do in every Mass. I find it very striking that even on Easter Sunday, on the day that we are celebrating the resurrection of Jesus, we still reenact his suffering, death, and resurrection on the altar. You know,
right?
There is no Easter without Good Friday, and
right.
By the same token, there's no Good Friday without Easter, because the Good Friday liturgy, the Good Friday service, is part of a larger liturgical whole that stretches from Holy Thursday to Easter. Am I just repeating all the stuff that you already said?
No, actually, you're not.
Okay.
And that's part of the reason that they wanted me to write the piece is because it's during the Easter. Oddly enough, although every single Mass is about the passion, death, and resurrection of Jesus, astonishingly, for a lot of people, that connection is not made. And so the liturgy is this thing that we do. Why do we do it? Well, we do it because we're Catholic, and that's what Catholics do. But it's really at the Triduum that it's like made super explicit. See this story that we're hearing right now during these 3 days, and we're hearing this whole story over and over again. That's why we always have Mass, is because we're this is the story that we're entering into. The rest of the year, a lot of people, you can go to Mass and, well, there's, okay, we just heard something about this thing that happened to David once. I'm not really clear on what that has to do with anything. And then there's this gospel reading, and it has something, it's some story about something that Jesus did, or some saying that Jesus had. But how that connects to what goes on in the liturgy of the Eucharist, I don't know.
Well, I want to keep talking about this.
Okay, yeah, and so we will. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis, and we will be back talking about the Passion, Death, and Resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth right after this on Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. We've fallen into a little discussion here that both of us are interested in, so we'll just have to wait for the we're going to talk about the Oscar nominations, but we'll get there. But this is really important. One of the things that Sherry Waddell has spoken about in her book, Forming Intentional Disciples, which if you haven't read it, you really need to rush right out and get it. I think it's one of the five most important Catholic books of this decade. I really do. It's hugely important. And one of the things she talks about is the idea of breaking the silence. We as Catholics do not talk about our faith, partly because we're uncomfortable, because we're not sure how to talk about our faith. We're not sure that we know what we're doing. We don't want to screw things up, so we just don't talk about it. And yet, one of the results of that is that we have whole generations of people who are raised who don't see a connection between what's going on in the Mass and the person and work of Jesus Christ. That it's not clear to them that there is any connection. I mean, we talk about Jesus during the Mass, so you hear the name of Jesus, but what does this have to do with what goes on in the God? A lot of people don't see it. And the place where it's made clearest, the connection is made most explicit and clear, is during the Triduum, during the 3 days where the Church really goes out of her way to recall the events of the Passion, Death, and Resurrection of Jesus Christ. And so that's where you hear the story told. The story of the Passion is told then. And the rest of the year, what we're looking at are other aspects of the gospel that radiate from that central event.
Yes.
Everything is about that.
The Catechism says, beginning with the Easter Triduum, as it's significant that it doesn't just say Easter, but the Easter Triduum, beginning with the Easter Triduum as its source of light, the new age of the resurrection fills the whole liturgical year with its brilliance. Gradually, on either side of this source, the Easter Triduum, the year is transfigured by the liturgy.
Right.
This is... You used the word before the break. You talked about the story that is being told. And I think people don't necessarily realize that the liturgy is precisely telling a story. And mm-hmm. each Mass tells the story, but in a way, each Mass is also part of a larger narrative, as you can see sometimes as we follow Jesus, you know, through the Gospels. For instance, right now, we're in the middle of a cycle that's going to carry on from last Sunday through all of the Sundays of February until Lent begins on March 1st, in which we will be reading from the Sermon on the Mount. So then the Sermon on the Mount is central to Jesus' teaching, and so we're kind of walking through that. But then in Lent, we're going to begin a new chapter in the story of Jesus. But it's not just the readings. The whole Mass and the whole liturgical year, you know, as you go to Mass, for instance, just to take one aspect of it, mm-hmm. and we see the liturgical colors come and go. So there are green vestments, usually sometimes they're purple, sometimes they're red. Sometimes they're white, and, you know, at Christmas time we have poinsettias, and at Easter time we have lilies. And people, I think, very often kind of go through all of this, and, you know, they see that all these things come and go, and they don't necessarily take a step back and see the big pattern, you know.
Right.
A story that begins on the first Sunday of Advent and goes through to its climax, which is the Feast of Christ the King at the end of the year. Now,
right,
very, very fittingly, is this, and the story that is being told is precisely the story of salvation, the drama of salvation history. It's a story that has God as its author, and it's thousands of years in the making, beginning really with the creation of the universe, and then going through the creation of man in God's image, and the tragedy of sin and death, and God's plan to redeem the world, to set the world free from sin and death, and, you know, going through until the second coming, all of that history compressed into the 52 weeks of the year.
Right. Right. And then repeated, you know, each year. But at the focal point of the whole thing is the great story, that is the passion, death, and resurrection of Jesus.
Which is the climax.
That's the thing that illumines everything. So if you need a picture in your head, think of the hub of a wheel. Every spoke on the wheel is connected to that hub. And so throughout the rest of the year, every time you go to some ordinary Mass in the middle of ordinary time, sometime in September, you know, when nothing big is going on, that Mass is always taking you back to the events that unfolded in those 3 days.
Yes.
Holy Thursday, Good Friday, and then on into the Easter Vigil, which we celebrate on a Saturday and is recalling the events of Easter Sunday morning. But that's what it's always all about. And if you don't know that story, you're not going to get it. And a lot of people don't know the story. And so if we
should also point out that the liturgy, we should point out that the liturgy is telling a story, but it's not just it's not just pageantry. It's not just
right.
a telling or an acting out. In the words of Pope Paul VI, in the document from 1969, in which he reorganized and reformed the liturgical year, he said that the unfolding of the liturgical year is not just a commemoration. of the actions by which Jesus has brought about our salvation. Right. Nor is this unfolding, again, we're talking about the liturgical year, nor is it merely a commemoration of past events so that the faithful, even the more simple, might be instructed and nourished by meditating on them. The celebration of liturgical year, this is all Paul VI, the celebration of the liturgical year, quote, enjoys a sacramental force and a particular efficaciousness to nourish the Christian life. And then the Catechism goes on saying that in the liturgical year, we Christ himself is ever living in his church and continuing the journey of immense mercy that he began in his mortal life. So, you know, we don't just go to Mass to watch pageantry or to remind ourselves of what Jesus did on those 3 days. We go because what he did on those 3 days is still going on and is made present to us in its saving power. And that is what is happening in every Mass.
Yeah. And so the Mass is, I mean, in a certain sense, it's a crude analogy and it's not really a very accurate one, but I mean, the Mass is a little bit like a time machine. When you go to Mass, you are entering into, you're there at the foot of the cross. You're there at the mouth of the empty tomb. You are present in the upper room with the risen Christ. That's happening now to you. And yet, if you don't know the great story, it can all happen and you cannot see it.
Right.
Which is why for every person that enters the church, 6 people are leaving. Because those 6 people are not making that connection. They're not seeing it. They're not seeing that they're entering into that encounter with Christ crucified and raised from the dead and ascended to heaven. And so making that connection with what's called the great story, the technical term is the kerygma, it's absolutely essential. And so learning how to articulate what that great story is, you know, the church has given us a huge help in that direction. If you don't know what else to say, if somebody asks you what's the great story, you can tell them because you already know it if you're a practicing Catholic who knows the creed, because that's what the creed is. The creed is the great story in crystalline form. Another way of encountering the great story, it's called the Rosary. The Rosary retells the great story, and it points out sort of key life events in the life not only of Jesus, but also, and because this is really important, also it gives us one disciple that we can look at the life of Jesus through her eyes. And it's his greatest disciple. So when you're saying the rosary, what you're doing is you're looking at the life of Jesus through the eyes of the Blessed Virgin Mary. And you're seeing how that life was lived out. And the reason that it's important to see Jesus through the eyes of his greatest disciple is because the thing is that Jesus, there's one thing that Jesus, God though he is, can't do for us. He cannot show us what a disciple of Jesus looks like. Only a disciple of Jesus can do that. And so we have Mary as that model disciple to show us what it looks like to be a good disciple of Jesus. And all of that is necessary because the whole point of the great story is that we receive the benefits that he has won for us by his passion, death, and resurrection. That's what this whole thing is about.
Which, of course, raises the point that the good news implies the bad news. Let's talk about that when we come back.
We'll talk about that when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis talking about the great story of Jesus. And we'll be back on Connecting the Dots right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Redbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Stephen Gradonis, Deacon Stephen Gradonis. We've been talking a bit. We both got interested in this. We've been talking about connecting the great story of Jesus, which, I live here in the least church city and the least church state in the nation, Seattle. And if you stop the average Seattleite on the street and ask them, why does Jesus matter and what did he do? You are already a weirdo just for raising that question. Before you even get to the answer, just the fact that you brought it up already makes you stick out. And the answers that you will get to that question are anybody's guess. I think the average Seattleite would say something like, he was a great teacher. You know, some of them might say, well, he was a martyr for justice, something along those lines, which is true, but it's kind of like saying that Shakespeare was a really good speller. It's like, that's, yeah, okay. Or, you know, Einstein did good work at the patent office, but
it's funny that you say that, because I'm thinking, and I had been thinking just before the break about Suzanne's story, being raised in an American Baptist church, a liberal mainline type Baptist denomination, and feeling on Good Friday that the point of Good Friday was that, you know, Jesus was a good man who had died, and we should feel really bad about that because he didn't deserve it, but not seeing the connection to her own experience. And directly concomitant with that disconnect is with a failure to understand the goodness of Good Friday, to, you know, make a kind of a pun, since the name Good Friday actually comes from God, not from good.
Okay.
But the failure to make that connection between the death of Jesus and the goodness of Good Friday, to understand that in the context of good news, comes from an unwillingness to grapple with the reality of bad news, with the reality that we are a fallen, sinful people, that we live in a fallen world, that death is a problem. That the goodness of God and the state that we live in, there's a contradiction. There's a tension there. There's something that needs to be resolved.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that goes with it, which I think is really, really interesting, Pope Benedict has remarked, you know, that one of the things that really drives the atheist critique of theism, of course, is rage at the problem of evil, and anger at God for the problem of evil, combined with an assertion that there is no God there to be angry at, which is very curious. And so one of the things that goes with that, for example, is, why did Jesus have to die on the cross? Christianity is just so dark. And I remember hearing a feminist theologian a few years back complaining about Christianity being this, you know, this cult, you know, with all this blood and you know, and death and all of that at the heart of it. And we should just get rid of all that, the blood and the weirdness and all of that. Get rid of all the cross stuff because it's too dark. I talk about, you know, the reign of justice and et cetera. And I think one of the things that was really, really helpful for me in making a way of approach to the mystery of the cross, because it really is a mystery, was looking at this question of, why did Jesus have to die that kind of death? And usually the way the question is put is, why did God want Jesus? You know, why would a loving God subject his son to a death like that? is usually the question that's put. And it's a very interesting way to put it, especially if you're an atheist, of course. Because if you're a really consistent atheist, the first thing you have to do is take God out of the equation. If you're an atheist, my question to you would be, why did we subject Jesus to that kind of death? Because if you're a consistent atheist, there is no God there doing that to him. We did that to him. And that, I think, really puts things in a different light when we approach Jesus from that angle. What the Christian gospel says is that God, who is love, handed himself over to us completely and said, do whatever you like with me. What would you like to do with me? And our species looked at perfect love and said, what we really want to do to you is beat the living daylights out of you and crown you with thorns and then spike your living body to a cross and laugh at you while you gasp out your last breath. That's what we want to do. And that's what we did. And that's what happened in the crucifixion. And God said, I will let you do that to me. And so we did. And in that death, what Jesus does is he lets us demonstrate why it is we are a species that needs that act of redemption for us, because that's what we are and that's what we do. And so in that mystery, what he does is the mystery allows us to see who we are. And at the same time, he takes exactly that means, that manner of death, and turns it into salvation for us.
It's also, of course, what we do to one another whenever we can.
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
And what happens as a result of the crucifixion is that, you know, in a certain way, when we suffer, when we are persecuted, when man demonstrates his inhumanity to man, we are no longer alone in our sufferings. God suffers with us. You know, where was God when, 6 million Jews were being thrown into gas ovens? God was in the gas ovens. That's where he was. He is with us in our sufferings.
Yeah. And that, you know, that is, it's astonishing to see that is the depth to which God is willing to go in order to save us. And so it shows really the darkness of human depravity, of course. And it illustrates Jesus's own warnings about the possibilities of hell, because we show who we are in our response to him. But at the same time, even in that act of rejection, that radical act of rejection of God, once we got our hands on God, this is what we chose to do to him, God turns that into the occasion of our salvation and so rises from the dead in the resurrection. It's the other astonishing news, of course, of the gospel, is that Christ is really raised from the dead, not symbolically, not, you know, he lives on in the thoughts of his disciples, or, you know, they all had warm feelings about him after his body was eaten by dogs and stuff like this. No, the message of the apostles really is, now he's not a ghost. He's not living on in our thoughts. We ate some fish with him, and we poked our fingers into his side, and we talked to him, and this went on for 40 days. And no, he really is actually alive.
And we're so, again, it's not just as his sufferings inform our sufferings. His triumph over death informs us in every grief that we suffer, every loved one that we bury, every every one of us that faces the hour of our death. His death and resurrection transforms everything. Before, death was permanent. It was the most permanent thing that there was. Now it has an expiration date. Death has an expiration date. It's only known to God, but and that in turn, you know, it how could it not transform, therefore, the way that we worship also? You know, before this, God's people worshiped on the seventh day, on the Sabbath, in honor of the completion of God's work of creation. Now we worship each week on the first day, on the Lord's Day, celebrating the beginning of God's new creation, because what started in that sepulcher, in that that rock-hewn tomb, is going to spread. It's going to spread. It's going to spread to every man, woman, and child who's ever lived and ever died, and it's going to spread to all of creation, to throughout the cosmos.
Yeah, and so, you know, I mean, it absolutely changes the way that the disciples look at absolutely everything, including their own Jewish heritage. So when they see the temple now, they see the body of Christ. Destroy this temple in 3 days, I will raise it up. When they see the Sabbath, they see the Sabbath as a prefiguration of Christ. When they look at the Passover lamb, when they see the miracles that God does in the Old Testament, everywhere they look now, they realize Jesus was hidden in all of this because he's the author of all of this. And it changes their whole approach to all of the universe and all of life. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are with Deacon Stephen Gradonis talking about the great story of Jesus. And we'll be back right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Welcome back to Connect the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. Well, we've been having such an interesting conversation. I've been waffling back and forth during the break. Do we want to just keep talking about this because this is super interesting, or should we talk about the Oscar picks? I think we'll talk about the Oscar picks. If you're out there in radio land and you're saying, no, keep up the conversation about the give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, and we can change course back to the great story if you want. But I think we'll move on and talk about the Oscar picks now. What's going on out there in Oscar world?
Well, it looks like this year is going to be a relatively not that exciting year at the Oscars. There are a lot of pretty sure things, and the best picture race has gotten
resurgence.
Well, the best picture race has gotten a little bit more interesting recently, but basically there's a rule that if there is an Oscar bait movie that's about Hollywood, that's about making movies, or that's about show business, or that at least that's set in Los Angeles, it's about LA.
I see where you're going with this.
It's the most important subject in the world, right? So, of course, the Academy loves it. And this year, that movie is, of course, La La Land.
Right.
By Damien Chazelle, who is responsible for Whiplash.
Words like responsible, that usually means bad.
Well, not necessarily, but in this case, you know, I admired Whiplash when I first saw it, but now that I've seen both of these movies, I see some really interesting critiques about some of the recurring patterns in his film. So I'm sort of rethinking Whiplash. This isn't to say anything bad about Emma Stone or Ryan Gosling, the stars of La La Land, although, you know, there's certainly no Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers. But I didn't think that La La Land deserved as much love as it's gotten from the Academy. It's tied for the all-time number, most nominations in history, with only two other films. 14 Oscar nominations is the maximum that any film in history has ever gotten. In 1950, All About Eve set that record. In the 1990s, James Cameron's Titanic equaled it, which is Hollywood congratulating itself in another way, the biggest box office winner of all time. And now La La Land, 14 nominations. The other two most nominated films, Moonlight and Arrival, which of course we've talked about on this show, are tied for second place with 8 nominations. I do want to say of the next rank, the third rank below that, Mel Gibson's Hacksaw Ridge is one of the films that has the next number of nominations, and arguably it's the most honored of them because one of those is the Critical Award for Cinematography. And in order to be a serious Best Picture candidate, a movie has to be nominated not only for Best Picture but also for Best Director, for Best Cinematography, and Best Editing. And Hacksaw Ridge at least has cinematography. So
All right. So what else? What else is happening out there?
Well, I should say, of the remaining films, and there are 9 nominees for Best Picture. There are only 5 Best Director slots. So that means Hell or High Water, Hidden Figures, Fences, and Lions are, they're out of the running almost before you consider anything else. I should say, 2 of these films are fantastic. Arrival, we've talked about to death, is my number 9 film of 2016. But almost alongside it came down to the wire, David Mackenzie's Hell or High Water. This is a great film. It is a modern day Western slash a road movie crime thriller. It has echoes of late 1960s, early 1970s crime movies like Dog Day Afternoon and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. But it's also doing a really interesting thing with a couple of recent Coen Brothers films, No Country for Old Men and True Grit. But it has a post 2008 recession vibe all its own. Just a terrific, terrific script, some great performances. Jeff Bridges was nominated for supporting director for playing this aging Texas Marshal, Texas Ranger rather, who's on the trail of the two brothers, Chris Pine and Ben Foster, who are robbing banks. And one of the things that I love about the film is that although we watch the robberies and we see everything that the brothers do, Jeff Bridges' character comes along behind them investigating, and he explains things to us, the audience, about what they're doing.
Okay.
Great, great film.
I've heard good things about it. I heard the script was terrific.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Okay, good. What else?
Let's jump from Best Picture and talk about Best Animated Feature. This is always a category that I'm interested in, although Disney has owned the category far too many of the last 10 years or so. I think there was only one year that it went to something else. It went to Rango. This year, it looks like Zootopia, unfortunately, is the front runner. And it's not because I don't like Zootopia. I do. It's a very nice film. I've seen it twice. I would gladly watch it again. But there are two films that are better, and one of them is Kubo and the Two Strings, in spite of a weak denouement. Everything up until then is just brilliant and wonderful. Leica Animation doing great, great things with stop motion. But the best animated film of 2016 is clearly The Red Turtle from Studio Ghibli. It's a collaboration of Studio Ghibli and a Dutch animator named Mikael Dudokduit. And he takes, the thing that Pixar started, and everybody's doing it now. They make these great little animated shorts told entirely without dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
They play.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So he's made a film that has that kind of power and mythic force stretched out over feature length. It's a story of love and survival, and it's naturalistic, but it's got elements of magical realism, and it's just absolutely amazing. The Red Turtle. I just don't understand how the Academy can look at Zootopia and say that's a better film than The Red Turtle. But what are you going to do?
It does have a good line, though. That line where the guy says, "Stop trying to reduce everything to a simple song from a cartoon. Just let it go." I thought that was really, really funny. But oh, well. Anyway.
Yes. Yes.
So, all right. What else? What else is happening out there?
Oh, so let's see. Who do you think should win
for Best Picture?
Of the films that are nominated, I think it should definitely go to Arrival. And on that note, I want to say, I want to say that we use the word snub in film criticism and commentary a little too freely. What we really mean by snub is a movie I liked that the Academy just didn't. I think you could argue that Silence, Martin Scorsese's Silence, was snubbed. I would have loved to see, they only nominated 9 films. I would have loved to see Loving in that extra slot, or The Witch, or, how about Patterson? not very likely, but there is one snub this year. Amy Adams for Arrival. The movie completely rests on her performance, and it's an amazing performance. And I just think she's so consistently good that somehow the Academy is starting to overlook her. And Meryl Streep did not need another nomination. I just think what we need to do is we need to move her into her own category. We need to create special Oscar. Best Performance by Meryl Streep. And then we can free up that slot for other actresses that deserve it more.
I hear you. Yeah, it's true. It's just, it's not fair anymore. You know, she's like the New York Yankees. I mean, come on. Enough. Just shut up. Go away. Step down. Let somebody else have it for a while, you know? But I agree. It's weird that Amy Adams does. I mean, she's just consistently really good.
Yeah.
Speaking of snubs, and I think you really do have to call it a snub. Come on. Oliver over 2001, A Space Odyssey. What was that about? You know, I haven't gotten over that. That happened in 1968, and I still can't sleep at night over that. It's just, it was wrong. But anyway.
Have we talked about Moonlight on this show?
No.
Well, the show's about to end, so we can't really get into it now. But I'll just say this. Moonlight is a film that's gotten a lot of love from critics. It is the one film that could possibly take the Oscar from La La Land, the Best Picture.
Okay.
And it is it's based on a play. It's about growing up black and gay in Miami. And if it wins over La La Land, I will actually be happy because I think it's a better film. And so we can talk about that next week.
Very good. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and you've been listening to Deacon Stephen Granados and I chatting about Oscars and the great story. And we will be back on Monday with Sherry Antonetti. Our producer today was Danny Head, and our listener today was you. Thank you. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.